So what I'm seeing is that in the job that we do every day, we've suddenly got an acceleration. It's not going to take $100 million anymore to make a complicated hardware product. It could take like a tenth of that. And so now suddenly, hardware is going to become kind of a cool thing to invest in because it's not going to take as much money to do it. And to the extent that AI moves from large language models to what they're calling world models, as that happens, we're going to start having AI that's able to design hardware.
Welcome to Hangar X Studios, where former fighter pilot and host John Ramstad takes us on a journey across aerospace as it enters an historic period of innovation and transformation. Our guests include aviation experts, pilots, financiers, military leaders, and innovators of all types. Buckle up for another episode of Hangar X.
Welcome to the Hangar X Studios podcast, and this is where innovators and investors and CEOs come to get the information before the rest of the industry so they can make decisions that are critical today, as so much is changing and accelerating in this landscape. And we're brought today by our sponsor is Hangar X Daily. They read 800 to 2,000 articles that come out every single day in our industry and look through them and sort them and say, hey, here's the 8 to 10 top articles that you need to read and why. It's a tool our entire team uses to stay up and current with everything happening in 5 minutes. So go to hangarxdaily.com and you can subscribe. It's free. It's what our entire team uses here. So, today we're going to be talking with Brian Hinman. So, Brian, first of all, welcome to the podcast from SciFly.
Thanks. Good to be here.
And, one of the things, is we look at drones, and I was looking at just even some agricultural drones, and they fly 6 to 8 minutes. So they have to go out and spray a lot of stuff and then, think about just the cycle times to go get a field done. And most drones today are really limited by endurance, by minutes, not by missions. There's a lot of missions. There's a lot of use cases that we're all talking about. Some of them are very excited. But what you did, and you've been a very successful entrepreneur, is actually start a company to change that equation. So before we kind of dive into your bio and some of the other things, what was it that prompted you to actually, because SciFly, your is built on rotor technology like in a helicopter, not what a traditional drone would do. So I'd love for you to share, what was that time when you said, hey, you know what, here's a problem I can solve, so let's go start a company to go do that.
Yeah, so that was 4 years ago. We started the company 4 years ago. And at the time, everybody's flying under Part 107, and 107 has sort of defined the industry for the last, what's it been? Since 2016, I guess it is. And it effectively boxes you into applications that are visual line of sight applications unless you apply for a waiver. And so there hasn't really been that much of a need for endurance, right? If you're always flying where you can see the thing, how long do you really need to stay up there? I can come down, swap batteries, get back in the air again. But once you break that regulatory limit, which is really what 107 has been, and you start imagining now it's Part 108, that was not a thing back when I got started. But as you start moving into beyond visual line of sight applications, endurance starts mattering big time. Aerodynamics start mattering big time. I need to go someplace. I need to have forward flight characteristics that if you look at a lift to drag equivalent, it starts looking like more like an airplane, right? Because I need to go someplace and I need to get back again. So that's really what motivated me, was the belief that we were soon going to have the predominance of drone operations beyond visual line of sight, that was not going to be the exception. It was going to be the majority of it. And what does the world look like as we move from visual line of sight to beyond visual line of sight missions? Everything changes. So to me, it was like an opportunity for a complete reset in the industry, where the industry has been dominated by DJI, a complete reset opportunity here where the drones are going to be cloud native, right? It's not a point-to-point link anymore. They're talking to the cloud. Wherever you control it from is going to the cloud. That's a complete reset. We have the onset of AI coming into play. So we have autonomy in the mission planning, in the mission itself, in the analysis of the data. This is a complete reset that's happening. And so that's what motivated me to start SciFly.
Well, I love that. So a little background, everybody, on Brian, CEO and founder of SciFly. You guys are building the long endurance autonomous drones, helicopter performance, and also I love that you're focusing on this dramatically lower cost. So we need to be able to drive, you know, fly these drone missions where you know, a company can operate profitably. Serial entrepreneur, multiple category defining companies. So this is pretty cool. PictureTel, Polycom, Two Wire, multiple IPOs, multiple exits. So. You know how to build and scale and probably hire some amazing people and build a great culture. You're also an innovator with deep technical roots, dozens of patents, and you solve problems. So we love all of that here, Brian, because that's the, you know, that's what, you know, lifts the whole industry up, the kind of work you're doing. And you talked about two concepts there in the opening, endurance and autonomy. Which one do you think is the precedent?
Well, you have to start with endurance, because if you've got autonomy but you don't have endurance, you're back to the I'm going to do some line of sight missions where I've got autonomy. And there's certainly applications for that. It's not as interesting to me, though, as when you can put the endurance on it, because that opens up the possibility to do things that we never could do before.
Yeah, and as you started going in engineering, you're looking at a lot of the traditional drone architecture. But then you brought in really rotor or helicopter technology. What was it that led you, I think, to that conclusion, that this is how we're going to actually create a platform that's really ideal for BV loss applications?
So if you look at what we have, and if you look at the Q12 as an example, it doesn't look like anything else that's out there.
That's the smaller one, right? The Q12?
The smaller one, exactly. Yep. It doesn't look like anything else is out there because we, from the very beginning, rethought what a drone should look like, again, that's going to fly beyond visual line of sight. And you can make a drone in lots of different forms. They could be, they could be tilt rotors. We see a lot of that VTOL and manned aircraft. You see lift plus cruise configurations. You see multi-copters. You see tail sitters. You see lots of different things. It was my proposition at the beginning that you should really be looking at something like a quadcopter optimized for forward flight if your missions have a mixture of hovering and forward flight. And I think that a lot of missions are like that. Even the missions when you don't intend to be necessarily in hover, you're going to end up in hover. If you're talking about like manned aircraft, at airports, for example, there's going to be a need to be hovering. So the architecture that we have, which is this essentially quadcopter optimized for forward flight, I think it has applicability not only for UAVs, but hopefully in the future also for manned aircraft.
Well, yeah, and you make the claim that you can deliver helicopter-like performance at, drone cost. So what had to change in the tech stack, both hardware and software, to bring that into, to bear that out?
Well, a lot of it has to do with the aerodynamics of the aircraft. There's a couple of basic things before getting into like a bunch of the details in the tech. One of them is that the battery weight fraction that most aircraft operate with, electric eVTOLs, the battery weight fraction is too low. And
what do you mean by that? Battery weight fraction. Explain that a little bit.
So if you look at your total full up weight of the aircraft, let's say before you put some payload on or whatever, but if let's say you've got enough sensor to get the job done, like ask yourself the question, like what percentage of the weight of that aircraft should be in battery?
Okay.
And it turns out there's an answer to that. There's an explicit answer to that, which is it's 2/3. And it turns out the math is different, but you come to the same conclusion for electric airplanes as well. You want to get to 2/3. It's hard to do that, right? Because that's a lot of battery.
And how did you land on 2/3?
So it falls out of the power equation for a rotorcraft, that the power equation is, it's equal to your thrust raised to the 1.5 power and then the stuff on the denominator. But it's the numerator that you look at it. If your power is growing faster than linear at 1.5, then when you take the derivative, you go through the math, blah, 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 it ends up being the reciprocal of 1.5, which is 2/3. So, yeah, that's the answer. And so if you look at the battery weight fractions of like all of the eVTOLs, including UAVs, they're all way too low. And so as a result, you don't have the endurance that you want. But there's other important things happen there. It pushes you towards battery technology that is high power, because you need to have typically like a 3C discharge rate, meaning you're discharging the battery in a third of an hour. But it also means that you're going to be hurting the batteries as far as their ability to survive long term. Both, you know, typically you're discharging at this high rate, you're also charging at a high rate. So it's a complete game changer. Once you can get your battery weight fraction up high enough, you don't have to use the high power cells anymore. You can use the high energy cells, and that's what we use. We use EV batteries effectively. So they're a lot less expensive. And because we're discharging them so slowly, and we typically charge slowly as well, the batteries last for much longer. So it ends up being a huge savings for the customer. So just that one simple thing, which is getting your battery weight fraction up higher, is a game changer by itself. And that's not rocket science. That's just like, look at the math, and it says, yeah, you want more battery on board.
So let's just say, example, make it easy. If I want to, I have a 100-pound payload target, either for the sensors or the, you know, the mission of this drone. So you use that to work backwards into the size and the design of the drone, knowing that two-thirds of this is going to be battery?
Well, it's hard. I mean, if you have a payload that's as heavy as the aircraft itself, then you can't get to two-thirds.
Right.
But, you know, to the extent you can, you want to push it. And the way the curve looks in terms of efficiency, it's fairly flat up to two-thirds, and then it kind of goes down after that.
Okay.
So you want to get to at least like 50%. Like if you can get to 50% battery, you're in a happy place. As you start dropping off from that, then your discharge rates start, you know, going up higher and higher as you're flying. So for us, like when we're hovering, if you get to two-thirds battery, and this, I'll get to the next one, you can hover for a couple of hours. Now your battery's never getting hot. And your battery is very happy operating in those conditions. So if you're discharging at like a half a C rate and you charge at that kind of rate, the batteries are going to last a long time. And you're going to be able to use a less expensive chemistry that has the highest possible energy density.
And have you guys considered hybrid electric as part of that?
Yeah, so I spent a lot of time looking at that, especially for the larger ones. Hybridization is not an easy thing on a small UAV because internal combustion engines just don't scale very well. You get up to a size where you can, for example, use like a Rotax 912 IS. It starts looking pretty good. But you still, I mean, even then, even a great engine like the Rotax 912 IS, it's got a 2,000-hour TBO. And, you know, I just argue that pure electric just has so many reliability benefits coming from it. It also has noise benefits coming from it that we're exceptionally quiet. I mean, we'd be a lot quieter in the rotors than we would be in the engine. So for a lot of the applications that we're addressing, pure electric is just a better way to go.
Is your rotor system quieter than, let's say, a similar size drone with the traditional propellers?
Okay, so that gets to the next one.
Okay.
So battery weight fraction is critical. You got to get to a decent battery weight fraction. The next one is what's called disk loading. And that is how much weight do I have per swept area of the rotor?
Yep.
And the way the math works there as far as efficiency is you're getting longer and longer endurance as 1/√ of the disk loading. So you get a square root factor there. So what it sort of says is if that's the case, I want my disk loading to be zero or close to zero, and then I've got ultimate efficiency. That means you have giant rotors that are spinning around very slowly, and you'd be kind of like a butterfly. So you don't want to completely go there, because if you go there, you're not going to be able to survive very, very well in wind conditions, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's interesting mathematically, but I don't come to a closed form solution. It's not, there's no like two-thirds answer there. The answer there comes down to, from a mission perspective, what wind speed do you want to operate in? And so over the surface of the Earth, and at least over land, 90% of the time, the wind speed is 25 miles an hour or less. So we kind of targeted, okay, if we can make an aircraft that, for example, could fly in a 30-mile-an-hour wind, that's probably the right answer. And that kind of backs you into how low can you go in terms of disk loading. And my math on that ends up at about 0.9 pounds per square foot. And that's very low. So like we were talking about the Robinson as an example, the R22 is when it's empty, is like a 2.2 or something like that, yep. Pounds per square foot. So it's way lower than that. It's lower than any helicopter. I think Hiller had one that was down around one at some point, but it's lower than any helicopter that's commercially out there. So when you reduce your disc loading so low, you pick up a whole bunch of efficiency. But then another important aspect to it is that your tip speed of your rotor is going down to the point that it becomes inaudible at a certain distance. When you get to a certain distance, it just fades into the background. And one of the things that's kind of remarkable about rotorcraft math is that the noise coming from the rotor scales in proportion to the tip speed raised to the sixth power. It's a sixth power relationship, right?
So, okay.
So
let me guess, Brian, you're an engineer.
Yeah. So if you cut it in half, like you say, you go to a half, it's a half raised to the sixth power, which is you knocked the noise down by a factor of 64.
Right.
That's a huge deal. That's a huge deal.
It is a huge deal, especially, you know, as you're looking at, you know, public, you know, it's not more just that we got a drone that can do this thing. There's got to, you know, the public has got to want it. Communities need to, you know, they're going to have to be approving these things. Noise is going to be a consideration when you're not used to seeing them flying around. I think 5 years from now, we're going to be used to seeing drones in the sky on a regular basis in quantity. So it's going to be some big changes over the next few years.
Right. But, you know, it's one thing to see them and it's another thing to hear them.
Correct.
Because right? One thing, if they're there, but they're not making noise, then it fades into the background. You're not paying attention to it any more than, for example, when you drive down the road, you don't notice the fact that there's cameras everywhere now. There weren't cameras everywhere 20 years ago, right? So I think drones are going to be kind of the same way, but they have to, in order to fade into the background, they can't be annoying. They can't be like a helicopter, for example. So at 100 meters up in the air, our sound signature is around 38 dB SPL, and in a normal sort of environment, that just fades into, you can't hear it.
That's probably the dB of just my office here.
Right, exactly. Yeah, it's that kind of level. It's in that kind of level.
Hey, question for you, just a random thought. Are drones susceptible to vortex ring state? So maybe you could explain what that is and just what that might look like aerodynamically as you're looking at certain loads and mission sets.
They are. I'm glad you brought that up as a helicopter guy. And most drone people don't think about that. But as drones start becoming larger, it becomes a bigger consideration. So the vortex ring state is like you are, for example, moving down into your own wake. And you can get to a point where you create this it's like a torus of the air is coming down and then it's feeding into the top of the rotor and you're effectively getting no lift. And the thing kind of flutters to the ground.
Or if you add power, you actually accelerate your descent.
Oh yeah,
it's very unnerving.
Better for yourself.
Yep.
And the only way, and once you get into that vortex ring state, you need to push the cyclic over and get out, get some fresh air going. Because once you got that thing going, you're bad day is going to happen.
And how does that affect drones? And how did you think about that as a designer?
So the guys I work with are not necessarily all helicopter pilots. I think maybe one or two, but. When you're making larger drones, the stock code that you use, the open source code for taking off and landing with drones is vertical takeoff and landing. And as you know, as a helicopter guy, if you descend into your own wake, you get to a certain velocity where you can see the onset of it. And we never got to the point where we were full vortex ring state, but you could see it start happening because as you descend into your own wake, you start seeing a little bit of this instability happening. So if you're going slow, it's nice and even like that, but you descend fast into your own wake and you start seeing that kind of fluttering like a leaf in the air where, okay, you got to get out of that. So the initial thing the guys did is just slow down the rate of descent. But the thing I pointed out to them is, guys, we need to behave like a helicopter. And the first time this became critically important for us is last year around this time, I think it was May, we did this thing in Michigan called the Uncrewed Triple Challenge.
Okay.
And we had to carry 10 pounds for 65 miles in high wind conditions. And that's a recipe for disaster if you don't behave yourself as far as your flight goes. So we did that entire thing flying the way you would fly in a helicopter, which is, you know, you lift lift up the ground, off the ground, let's say you get up to like about a meter, and then figure out where the wind is, and we planned all this out ahead of time. You want to take off into the wind, and we would typically have a slope.
Do you do a running start or more of a high-performance start?
Kind of a high-performance start. We would just go straight out of it, slope up at 1/7.
Okay.
So that's the way we would do it. And then we would also come in the same way. So we had a bunch of these where we would do a downwind. And the worst is, like, if you didn't know any better and you got high wind conditions and you're a max takeoff weight and you're doing a downwind landing, you do a face plant because you don't have enough authority on the front rotors in a quadcopter case. You don't have enough authority to get the thing to stop. So you do like a face plant and then you flip over. So yeah, whenever you just behave like you're a helicopter or an airplane, you do the downwind, you turn base, you turn final and land into the wind again, doing a 7-1 slope down to your spot about 2 meters over the ground, and then bring it down nice and even. And that's the way we fly. That's the way we always fly, even if you're not at max takeoff weight, because that's kind of the right thing to do. It's a safe thing to do.
For a traditional, let's say, you know, Part 107 commercial drone pilot, was learning some of those techniques you're talking about that we use flying helicopters, was that pretty straightforward or a little bit, it took some practice?
There's still a skepticism with some of the guys, like, well, why do I have to do that? I don't have to do that with my DJI or whatever. You know, there's a certain skepticism that these things matter. And it's a function of like the scale of the craft and also a function of like, how close are you to maxing out on your max takeoff weight,
mm-hmm.
right? So you can get away with it. If you're lightly loaded, you can kind of get away with it. But it's when you're getting close to that max takeoff weight that you see the consequences of not behaving like you would with a helicopter.
Yeah, and I had another question. Something you said I took note of. You know, there's millions of drones being manufactured globally, right? And it's going to be interesting to see how everything plays out with DJI. But you also said that's a lot of these drones are not scalable. So what does it take for, I guess, a drone to be considered something that's more infrastructure versus a product?
Well, I think we're moving to that direction with the DFR applications, drone as first responder, where yep. the concept of operations has to include the whole thing. Like, how do we keep doing this thing 24/7? There are certain industries that are certainly moving that way. We've also seen it with some of the folks doing automated inspections that they want it to be an infrastructure play. So I think we're going to see more and more of that as time goes by. And in particular, how do we use automation to fly the missions so you can take the human beings out of it, especially as we start having more drones out there than we have pilots to fly them.
Yeah, and I agree. And question for you. So you've built a number of multi-billion dollar companies. What patterns are you seeing right now in this industry, in aerospace, globally, domestically, that you say, okay, this is why I'm going all in on what SciFly is doing?
Okay, well, this I have to tell you, this is I've been in telecom and most of my career. This is the weirdest situation I've ever been in, and I don't mean because it's like aerospace. I kind of knew what I was getting into. I love flying, et cetera. Now, the weird part about this whole thing is like people that don't come from the drone industry would say, you started a drone company, wow, that's like a really crowded space. And for the people that are in the drone industry, it's the opposite of that. There's like nothing available now, given the circumstances before us. And so for me, the remarkable part is that, you know, we don't have a problem of demand generation. We've got constant, you know, inquiries for our product because we're like the only thing out there that meets what we see as like the future requirements, these long endurance, beyond visual line of sight applications. And now, especially with, it wasn't a DJI ban, it ended up being like anything non-US manufactured ban in December. It just kind of like just wiped out a bunch of products that otherwise would be available.
Yeah, it's interesting. In what trends are you looking at that has you say, you know what, this industry is going to be something massive?
So we break it out as far as like industry sector, like the areas that we go after. We started out, we were like all ag all the time, and I can go through each of these, but we started out all ag. Why? It's a good size market. Again, our endurance plays in there for for the applications, especially for the surveilling applications where you're looking at plants and trying to figure out what's going on with them and so forth. And ag is a nice business from a regulatory perspective because you're not flying over populated areas, so there's not some issue that you're endangering people. So that's you know, it checks a bunch of boxes that way. But we very quickly, as we got out there and started talking to folks, realized that the public safety side of things is going crazy. And public safety includes police, fire, search and rescue, and kind of in that order as far as the demand signals are concerned. So the police side of things, a large fraction of police departments are now either already using drones or have drone programs that they're putting in place. And this is not only a U.S. phenomenon, it's a worldwide phenomenon. As a lot of police have said to me, you know, the future of policing is going to involve drones. So I think it's going to end up being an integral part of how we think about how police operate in the future. Fire is another one. You can think of so many ways that drones, both from a surveillance perspective, but also from a fire, putting out fire perspective, that's going to be a huge opportunity. And then search and rescue is another one where you're out there looking for people, having endurance, having payloads, that thermal payloads, et cetera, are obvious ways that we can start saving people where we don't need to use necessarily manned aircraft to do the job. So that whole sector, the whole public safety side of things to us, that of all the sectors, it looks like perhaps the fastest growing of any of them. The third one is what I would consider kind of the traditional bread and butter, linear inspection, mapping. I was frankly less interested in that because it seemed like it was already being well addressed by other players. But again, back to the whole endurance that we have, we become kind of a game changer. That, you know, we can cover distances that are, you know, 5 times, 10 times farther than what other people can cover. So it suddenly changes the economics for folks that are doing linear inspection and mapping to use our platform. So that's become quite a bit of, you know, the activity that we have going from a sales perspective. And then the last one is we've not been really focused on the military side of things. That has not been kind of our thing. We certainly probably, we don't see ourselves doing anything on the, quote, kinetic side. However, that said, the Q250, the platform that we had developed around ag applications, around spraying, the application on the military side that makes sense there is for what's called contested logistics. Yep. So bringing food and water to the front lines, for example, that's like a obvious use for that platform. So it's across the spectrum. You just put this all together, and this is like an enormous opportunity, and each of the four are at the very early stages.
Yeah, and if you think of, you know, as you've built the business and you're looking at what's happening with the global supply chain, I'd love for you to talk about that as far as, you know, doing more manufacturing. A lot of it's based in China. Some of it's trying to be onshored. But what have you found from that as far as an ability both for SciFly and then also maybe the industry as we're trying to scale?
Well, the world's getting a lot more complicated. I guess that's one way to put it. And it's restrictions both on the U.S. side as well as on the China side, which people are in the U.S. not as aware of. People in China are obviously aware of it. But on the U.S. side, and they're all different things. There's Blue UAS, which people have heard about. That's kind of a requirement on the military side. We were not going there, so we were not working on Blue UAS. Up until the end of last year, we thought, okay, well, we're going to do NDAA. We checked that box. NDAA in a nutshell is no Chinese microprocessors, and anything that has a microprocessor in it cannot be manufactured in China. That's the essence of it. There's a lot more, but that's the Reader's Digest summary of it. And then what happened in December was like a shock to all of us in the industry. We thought it was going to be a DJI ban, and what it turned out to be was a ban of all drones that are not manufactured in the United States. And this is prospectively, if you want to get certification under the FCC regulations, Part 15, for example, you need to be manufactured in the U.S. And it goes beyond like assembled in the U.S. The subsystems need to be made in the United States. And the subsystems, they call them critical components, include things like flight controller, got that, ground control station, got that, understand what that is. The list goes down, and then it gets down to batteries and motors. Well, we don't make that stuff here, and at least not very much of it. Maybe like, you know, military stuff or whatever, but in cost structure and volume, that would work for commercial applications. That's not something that we do in the United States yet. And so we saw that and we thought, well, that's a tough hurdle, but it's also, we're all in the same boat together. And so they provided an out for any aircraft that are Blue UAS listed or meet the Buy America Act, the 65% threshold. But everybody else is going to have to file for a waiver. And so we knew that. We knew that like immediately we saw it. And I was like, everybody's going to have to apply for a waiver. So we went through that process. I think by the time we submitted, maybe it was the third week in January. And I think we were in the first group of small group of companies that got through that. So, yeah, that was a process that was eye-opening. I had thought that going into it that the considerations were going to be about Chinese spying, Chinese controlling drones, but it turns out that the exercise is really about supply chain. It's about trying to ensure that in the United States over the long term, we have independence so that no country can hold us over a barrel, so to speak.
So this is more of a forcing function to start creating capital investment and interest in bringing that and onshoring that.
And that's going to happen. Yep. So one of the things it did for us, for example, is, yeah, I was planning on making a bunch of the subsystems at our contract manufacturing partner down in Malaysia. We still are going to do the battery modules down there, at least for this year. The rest of them, I'm moving to contract manufacturers in the United States so that those subsystems will indeed be manufactured here. And we still do have electronic system manufacturers in the United States that put together printed circuit boards and all of that. But when you get down to like batteries and motors, we're not there yet as an industry. So that's something that we're going to start seeing happen. And to your point, yeah, there's going to be capital investment to bring that stuff online.
Yeah. So I got to ask you, Brian, you've seen a lot of startups. You've been part of a lot, especially now as we're kind of almost talking about the drone industry, because we have a lot of startups, small, large OEMs. But what are some things you think founders are getting right now, and where do you think some of those maybe misunderstandings that they have about building a new company in this environment that maybe they're not seeing clearly?
Wow, there's a lot to unpack there. I think the two things that occur to me, one is like in the drone industry, I'll make a commentary about that, and then the other one is more broadly what's happening in the world right now. In the drone industry, and this is where we have to thank our government for doing this, the ruling that happened in December, there are too many drone companies in the United States of late, and this was not maybe the case a decade ago, but that have essentially been stringing together a bunch of third-party parts and making something that resembles a DJI drone as closely as they could do. That's not us. That's not what we've been doing, right?
So they're basically taking a box of Legos that everybody has access to, and they're pulling them apart, and they're just making something new with the Legos that are out there right now. Is that fair?
Yeah, and there's a bunch of websites and companies that are set up to do that, where you can buy all the bits and pieces and open source this and that and string it together, and you can get something flying in a fairly short order, but that doesn't constitute a commercially viable product, especially if you're trying to compete with DJI. But now the government's kind of stepped up and said, guys, this time out. That doesn't work, okay? We're not going to allow that. You got to go build all the stuff, meaning you got to design the subsystems to go into it. So I think this is an important step forward because it's going to stop this trend that we've seen, and this has been true for several years, where you've got a slew of, I think last count was 60 drone companies in the United States, and they're all kind of doing the same thing of stringing together a bunch of third-party electronics. There are exceptions, like Skydio, for example. They're certainly making all their own stuff. But when you get down, and Skydio has the revenue to support that as well.
Yep.
But then you get down into the long tail, so to speak, of drone companies, and it's a bunch of companies stringing together stuff. And this ruling in December has effectively said, no more, guys, no more. You got to design the stuff, and you got to build it here in the United States. So I think that's an important lesson to be learned within the drone industry, is it's time that we, as an industry, step up to the challenge, which is we actually have to design the stuff from scratch in the United States.
Yeah. And so in your humble opinion, what does it take to win today?
Well, and that gets into the next thing. I've been a hardware guy my whole career, and it's been harder and harder to raise money as a hardware guy over the last, 20 years, because it's, you know, typically it would be like, especially if you're doing chips and stuff like that, you got to put, as an investor, I got to put like $100 million into some deal to know if I'm going to come out the other side and this is going to be a multi-billion dollar company. Like, I got to make a huge capital investment to make that happen. And so over the last 20 years, we've seen the trend further and further that the venture capital dollars are more and more going into software companies because, hey, two guys can start some website company selling some, you know, online retail thing, and with a couple million bucks, we'll figure out pretty quickly whether they can get traction and turn it into a business. And then if it looks like they are, then we'll just give them more money, right? So this has been the trend we've seen, is the money is going into software-related things. Then 3 years ago, a miraculous thing came along of AI. AI is completely changing our lives. And we can either accept that this is like a game changer and embrace it, or you can ignore it and basically check out of society for the rest of your life. I mean, I think it's that simple. This is a bigger thing than the internet was by far, and we're never going to go back. This is not a fad. This is not going away. It's transformational. It's happening now. It's happening quickly. And if you don't embrace it, you're going to be left out. And so how does this relate? Well, it means that, and this is speaking as a hardware guy, software companies, we've seen software valuations crater because it's like, holy crap, AI can just like write the code. I just tell it and Claude will just write the code and it's great code. And what's going to happen to all these software companies? So now you've seen all the venture capitalists like suddenly, oh, they don't want to invest in software anymore because that's too easy. Well, hardware is still not there yet. And it's because the AI that we use today, large language models, they're language, it's text. So they do a really good job with things like programming. They don't do such a great job yet with things like two-dimensional, three-dimensional objects, even like, you know, if you've any used any of these AI for movie generation or even image generation, most of the stuff is pretty lame. So that said, though, it still can simplify the design of hardware items. So what I'm seeing is that in the job that we do every day, we've suddenly gotten an acceleration. It's not going to take $100 million anymore to make a complicated hardware product. It could take like a tenth of that. And so now suddenly hardware is going to become kind of a cool thing to invest in because it's not going to take as much money to do it. And to the extent that AI moves from large language models to what they're calling world models, as that happens, we're going to start having AI that's able to design hardware. You just tell it what the intentions are and it can start designing things. So in the extreme, you could just imagine in the future, you've got half a dozen people that can conceive and design something as complicated as like a Boeing Dreamliner. I mean, I think that's where it's going. And it's likely to happen within our lifetime. And that to me is either frightening or it's very exciting. And I personally find it super exciting because it means that I can make products that I could never have dreamed about doing with a small team before.
It is exciting. Yeah. One of my friends, CEO of a mid-sized business, but they brought in agentic AI 2 months ago. They have doubled their revenue in 2 months. Think about that. They doubled their top line revenue and they increased their margins in 60 days. There's a lot. We should actually do an episode for this just on agentic AI and how it can help accelerate things. But, you know, maybe this is a good way to wrap up. Such a great conversation. Brian, I'd love to have you back on. But let's just assume endurance starts to really unlock the potential of what drones offer us as a society, especially once BV loss passes. Now, along with that, we're going to have manufacturing like you just talked about, airspace policy, regulations, infrastructure, adoption, demand gen. Which of those areas do you think is the kind of the critical factor that helps unlock the potential of like what you're working on?
Well, I think the regulatory part of it certainly needs to progress. So we have Part 108 coming along. If you've seen it, it's an enormous document. It's like, oh my God, I hope this doesn't end up like Mosaic where it's going to take, you know, half a decade or something like that to be realized. So I think the acceleration of the regulatory framework, I think, is going to be an important part of it. In the meantime, you know, the things we're focusing on are A lot of waivers under 107 for the commercial folks. In the public safety side of things, we're going to start seeing it. It's going to become easier and easier. So today they operate either under what's called a certificate of authorization or a certificate of waiver. We're working with some folks on the thing that's called the National Public Safety Waiver. That's going to make it way easier for public safety organizations to adopt the technology. So I think that as far as mass deployments are concerned of drones, I think we're going to see it on the public safety side of things before, for example, we're going to start seeing a lot of like home deliveries of things by Amazon.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. Well, Brian, please, if you guys have any breakthrough, milestone, FCC certification, whatever it happens to be, please reach out. We'd love to, our audience, I'm sure, would love to stay in touch with the progress you're making. Come back on anytime.
Oh, I'd love to. Yeah, we're always trying to do fun stuff. I mean, in addition to trying to make money, because we are a business, we're always looking for fun things to do. So this summer's exercise is we're going to set a eVTOL distance record.
Okay.
And this is across any category. So the current record is held by Autoflight. They flew 155 miles. Prior to that, Joby flew 150. We're going to be able to do at least 190 miles, and we're going to try to break 200 miles. It's a nice even number. We're going to try to break 200 miles. So this is, it's to prove a point, but it's also fun to put some stuff in the record books.
Well, let me know when you do that. I'll come out. We'll film it, and interview you, and we'll make a great episode out of it, too.
Sounds great. Let's do it.
All right. Brian, keep knocking them alive out there. Thank you.
Thank you.